There can be at times a magical element to storytelling. This is the GWAA podcast, and I'm Amy Rogers. This month, Kevin Van Valkenburg joins me as we discuss the magic of storytelling, which he compares to fishing. It's one of the many topics we cover over the next 30 minutes. KVV, as he's commonly known, recently joined the team at Friday Golf and talks with me about his new role. He shares the details of his journey to the Fried Egg from his days at the Baltimore Sun to ESPN to No Laying Up. He discussed how Rick Riley shaped his early career, and he provides a super honest take about the challenges that aspiring journalists should be ready for if they want to try and break into the industry. But first, I asked KVV about his new role as the director of content at Fried Egg Golf.
You know, the nice thing about Fried Egg is that they were really already, you know, had an established voice and had an established brand. You know, it's 10 years in the making. Andy Johnson, you know, really, I think, tapped into a kind of a need in the golf space, you know, talking about architecture in a smart way. And then he and Brendan Porath, you know, when they started doing the Shotgun Start, really kind of tapped into, let's talk about pro golf in a funny, not super serious kind of way. For me, when I joined up there, it was just kind of a function of how can you fit into a place that is already great and try to make us better? How do you take whatever your talents are and meld them with ours? It's important when you join an organization, especially a smaller one, that you try to kind of, you know, fit your voice in with theirs, that you don't sort of just impose something. I'm not sure that would work super well if I just came in and started throwing around, you know, directions and stuff. Part of the cool thing about when they wanted me to come work for there is they were very clear about like, hey, Kevin, you know, like you are someone who we feel like can help us get better in a lot of different ways and you can podcast, you can write, and you can just sort of be yourself. That's what I've kind of in the last few months been focusing on is like, how can I use my voice in the spaces where it can kind of make us better, but also how can I, you know, advise people or how can I contribute? I mean, it's fun, honestly, to be part of a team that's so funny and so interesting and so smart the way they look at golf and just try to enhance that whatever way you can.
I mean, when we say content now, that can mean a lot of different things. Obviously, podcasts and video and writing. How do you kind of strike that balance of where to focus your energies on what types of content?
I think a little bit of it is just like feeling what the day calls for. I mean, my background obviously is in writing. I didn't really start podcasting until the last 5 years or so. I think what I always kind of think of things is like, would my writing help this situation? Would it enhance the sort of way that our company should take a point of view on this? Or would my observations be helpful here? And then the nice thing too is we have kind of an established rhythm. We have 4 or 5 podcasts a week, right? We have 3 Shotgun Starts. We have the Fried Egg pod. We have the Mixed Bag, our LPGA pod. And then there's also more podcasts at Designing Golf that Garrison Morrison does. We have a lot of different avenues to kind of talk about the world of golf and not just professional golf, but the world of golf that surrounds it. And I think that's one thing that Andy has always been really good at emphasizing is, you know, that on a really great week, you might get 4 or 5 million people watching a PGA Tour event. That would be a huge number but there's like 30 million people a week who are playing golf in the United States, Great Britain, Ireland, Scotland, Europe. So there's a huge audience out there that wants to think and talk about golf, not just in through a professional lens. And that's where I think Fried Egg Golf has been really good at is like meeting people where they are. What I'm curious about something, it doesn't necessarily have to be like what Rory McIlroy is doing, what Tiger's doing. It might be, I wrote an essay earlier this year that was just like, let's talk about like playing with one of your buddies, like and how cathartic that is and how good for your own mental health that can be. And it was like one of the most, you know, read things that I've written in a while, one of the things that resonated with people the most. And so that's a cool thing that maybe didn't have back when I worked at ESPN is you can write about recreational golf or sports in a way that just doesn't have to appeal to an audience that's interested in gambling or it's interested in just scores or interested in fantasy sports or whatever. It could just be like, what's the personal side of this?
Golf of late has become a lot more accessible for people and being able to make it more personal in those different ways. You have a bit of content on Rory McIlroy in recent weeks, calling it the year of Rory over on the Fried Egg. And you wrote a piece on Rory McIlroy and the art of being wrong about him winning the Masters. And You thought he wasn't going to win it. Why did you want to take this angle with this piece? You kind of took your own personal angle with this.
I think it's important to be honest with your readers. Hopefully a lot of my writing comes from an honest place. And so I thought it would be more interesting and more honest to say, you know what? Like, it's easy to say like, oh, I always knew he'd do it. Like I used to kind of cringe a little bit when I would hear Tiger and Phil and Gary and Jack and all these guys come into the interview room in Augusta and say like, oh, he'll definitely do it. He'll definitely do it. And I think I kind of understood Rory well enough to know that that wasn't helpful. They sort of thought it was going to be reassuring, and what it only did was kind of put more pressure on him. And so as I kind of was thinking about that, as we came up with this idea of like, what are the things that we could still say about Rory this year and to sort of talk about the emotional importance of this year, you know, could one of those be like my honest look back of like, yeah, I actually kind of thought you weren't going to do this. What a delightful surprise it is sometimes in the end to be wrong about that kind of stuff. Because there's not a lot of surprises sometimes in sports where everyone is always kind of try to prove like, I knew I was right. I knew that this Kansas City Chiefs dynasty was done. I knew that Scottie Scheffler was going to win, you know, multiple majors. And I think it's a lot more interesting sometimes if you're willing to be surprised and willing to admit. I didn't get to write about Rory's Masters win because I was working on a narrative podcast at the time. And so I just had a kind of a few leftover thoughts and details and things that I wanted to kind of write about, hopefully in sort of an eloquent way. And it just felt like a fun exercise to use that muscle in a way about an event that emotionally was very important to me to have witnessed. But I didn't really get to use my main skill that I had preparing 25 years for that moment in that moment. So just a little cleanup there, I guess, on my part.
You mentioned that in the piece that you wanted so badly to be able to cover one of Rory's major wins when he won another major, but then you didn't end up even writing about it. As you mentioned, you ended up doing a podcast instead. We spoke a moment ago about different types of content for different types of moments. Do you feel like you could have done more of a service to Rory in that moment if you were able to write versus doing the podcast, or were you able to still kind of meet the moment in a different way?
I'm really proud of the podcast that Noling Up and I did in that moment. You know, no one had ever done anything like it. We had negotiated for months and months ahead of time to with Augusta National to let us bring digital recorders on the property and have these pink stickers on them so that the security guards wouldn't tackle us and be like, what are you doing with these? And, you know, my colleague, Neil Schuster, worked really hard to make sure that we had established a trust with them. And so they let us do that. And, you know, when I say I didn't write anything, like I wrote a 8,000, 10,000 word script of like the podcast kind of coming together in real time, kind of essentially like every day I would write a little bit. And it was kind of one of those magical moments where we knew that Rory was going to be a story throughout the week. And so the podcast is sort of sprinkled with hints of like Rory is the story, not knowing at the time that Rory was going to win the Masters. You know, at some point we kind of crossed the point of no return of like, he's the story, whether he wins or loses. But really it was kind of a way just to sort of get people to understand, like, if you've never been to Augusta and, you know, 98, 99% of golf fans have never been and never will be, this is the best that we can do to give you like an on the ground feel for what it's like. And I had an idea and had done some of this in the sort of previous year with Knowing Up about how can we use podcasts to tell stories. I think the market is kind of saturated with podcasts where people just turn on the mics and have their opinions in terms of golf and in terms of sports, but there's not a lot of sports podcasts out there that take you on a journey and tell a story like, you know, This American Life or The Moth or Serial is a good example, like podcasts that made the magic of storytelling kind of come to life. I think what was neat about that is it wasn't really reinventing the genre, but it was taking, you know, a form that had been perfected outside of sports podcasting and bringing it to that. And so in the end, if I had written something, it kind of probably would have been lost in the sea of content that came out right after the Masters. You know, there was a lot of really wonderful stuff that was written about Rory winning, and I love kind of celebrating that stuff from colleagues, but there's only really one podcast that could sort of make you feel like you're reliving it as it's unfolding. My hope is that that podcast will be listened to for years and years to come, kind of the way that I read Rick Riley's game story about Jack Nicklaus winning the 86 Masters 50 times when I was a young journalism student and growing up, or somebody might have read Dan Jenkins writing about Ben Hogan or Herbin Wurrenwind writing about Sarazen's double eagle at 15. Like all of those things, I think, kind of became cultural, like sort of touchstones in the world of sports writing. hopefully in some ways, like this is my contribution to that canon in a way that storytelling evolves. And so I think some stuff like rises to the top and sticks around forever. And that was kind of my, I guess, ambition and hope is that this would be one of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what a departure from Masters Pass. You talk about Gene Saracen, the Double Eagle. There's no footage of that. If this sort of podcasting and recording opportunity could have been available in capturing Jack Nicklaus's victory in 1986, you touched on that a moment ago. You wrote a really interesting introduction about yourself on the Fried Egg, which I hope everyone will go over and give a read to learn a little bit more about you and how you got into golf. And you touched on that piece by Rick Riley and said that it really taught you an interesting lesson that really struck me, saying whenever the moment feels huge, start small. Did you use that approach in creating that narrative podcast?
I think so. I mean, I think like, you know, that podcast begins with Neil and I getting in the car and driving to the tournament. So you can hear the kind of beep, beep of the opening the car doors and slamming of the trunk. Riley kind of stole that a little bit from Jimmy Breslin, who, when John F. Kennedy was killed, instead of like going to write about like the memorial the day that John Kennedy was sort of lying in state, he went and interviewed the grave digger who was digging the grave for Kennedy. And it's kind of a famous piece in journalism because it sort of captured like the ripples of something can expand all the way out to the edges of something huge. When Jack Nicklaus won the Masters, Rick Riley talked about how one of the writers was sort of sitting in the old press tent there, just kind of rocking back and forth and saying, like, it's too big. It's too big. Like, I don't even know where to begin. And he kind of famously chose this image of the scoreboard operator changing the score to sort of show that Greg Norman had made a bogey on 18. And this guy stuck his arm out and was sort of like, the hell with objectivity. Like, Jack Nicklaus just won the freaking Masters. I've always kind of thought about that image, and I think it's a great way as a writer to sort of calm down in a big moment and to see like what's a little detail that you can bring people in and then slowly pull back the lens that can sort of, you know, talk about, holy hell, Rory winning the Masters. So in some ways like that podcast is that, and in its entirety, it's like we're beginning by getting in the car, driving to the course, and the security guard saying like, you know, hey, welcome to the Masters, come on through. And then it's like us tasting the sandwiches, and it's us walking the grounds and hearing the horn and interviewing people and certain capturing what the mowers sound like. And it really builds to like Rory McIlroy winning the freaking Masters, but you don't kind of know that as you're pulling it together. And so sometimes I think that's just like the magic of storytelling is like fishing, I guess, in a way. You cast your line out and you hope you catch a big fish, but you have no idea if you're gonna. You just have to make sure you make the right number of casts and have the right bait. And sometimes you get lucky and bring in a big one.
You caught a bit of luck here too in revisiting this Rory piece. You revealed that you were the one that ended up kind of stumbling into this response from Rory McIlroy when he lost the US Open at LACC. You were the last one to ask a question. And this has happened to all of us, I think, where you got a question in mind, someone else ends up asking it, and suddenly it comes to you, it's your turn. And you say you have just totally blanked. You just throw something random out there and you end up being the one gets this answer about Rory talking about, you know, he would have 100 Sundays like this one, ended up being, you know, just the quote of the week. What did you learn about yourself in that moment?
I've been talking to Rory kind of throughout that week. He had sort of allowed me and a couple other people just to sort of, you know, walk with him during practice rounds. And so we had talked about a lot of different things and sort of, I think, shared a friendly kind of camaraderie. In that moment, he was probably open to a question, even though he was sort of in a lot of hurt and pain of having lost yet another major from me, because he knew it came from sort of a respectful place. Sitting in those interview rooms, like you have to, in case anyone doesn't know how it works, like you have to raise your hand and kind of get the, or like get a nod from the moderator, sometimes like two or three questions ahead of time. And so, you know, you have what you think you want to ask in mind. And then someone, you know, who is also in line might have already asked that question by the time it's your turn. And the clock is always like ticking in your head, like how many more questions is this player going to be willing to ask? You know, someone asked the question I wanted to, which I honestly don't even remember what it was now. And I just kind of quickly in my mind was thinking, you know, man, like almost stepping outside of ourselves here for a moment. Like, I think it's a little bit maybe spiritually connected to what I was talking about before with like, you know, oh, you'll do it. Yeah. You'll know you win the Masters, you know, you win a major. Like the kind of more sobering reality is like, what maybe if it doesn't happen? And so I sort of asked him, you know, is it getting harder to stand up here and pretend like everything's going to be fine? Like you'll grow from this experience. And because the truth is sometimes it, you know, the scars are permanent. There isn't a happy ending to every sports story. And there very easily could have been no happy ending to Rory's Masters chase. I mean, if he doesn't come back and win that Masters, I think it's very fair to say he probably never does win a Masters. Like, it's just everyone sort of assumes that, you know, it's a movie script and it's going to write a great ending. But a lot of athletes just walk away feeling unfulfilled in their quest. To his credit, like, I think, you know, I asked him that. It was a pretty honest question. And he kind of smiled and said, yeah, it is, to be honest. But, and then gave like a really respectful, like not respectful, what's the right word, really interesting, honest answer. Like, when I do win one of these, it's going to be so, so sweet. And I'd go through 100 Sundays like this to get my hands on another major championship. And I just kept kind of turning that phrase over in my mind, 100 Sundays like this. What a beautiful book title that would be, like, about the arc of like how hard it is to win a major when you haven't won one for 10 years in some ways, because it had been a lot of Sundays. And just like, one of my favorite sports books ever written is a book called Sunday Money by Jeff McGregor. It's about NASCAR. And that's what Dale Earnhardt named his boat, Sunday Money, because, you know, Sundays were the days at NASCAR where you had to bring home the money. The idea of Sundays being kind of this day where, you know, it's the final day of a golf tournament. It's often just when we play football games. It's also kind of a day of when people, a lot of people go to church. Like, there's kind of this spiritual weight to it. And it just seemed like such a cool phrase. And I never really got to sort of use it. I mean, I used it in that story, but it almost, you know, came and went. I just kind of wanted to revisit it as a sort of thought about the Masters and stuff and be like, what a beautiful ending to kind of a story of, you know, the right Sunday did come along. And it really was cool for him to have that fulfilled.
Well, you mentioned something important there. To get that sort of response from Rory McIlroy, I don't think we can take lightly that you felt like you could have asked that, because you did have this relationship and there was an understanding and a respect there. How do you go about forging those sort of relationships so that you can ask some of those hard questions in those tough moments?
It's a sign of respect that, you know, it's not sucking up to an athlete, but it's sort of understanding that they have a job, but also that they're human. And so when you can talk to them in a way where you are not sticking a recorder in their face and saying like everything you say is going to be quoted, like, I think it's getting harder and harder in this era to do this. But when I was coming up as a football writer, working at the Baltimore Sun and then at ESPN, it was super beneficial to be able to talk to athletes without the idea of quoting them. Be like, hey, you know, I'm curious about this. Can you like be honest with me and explain to me like what was happening here? Or, you know, like, hey, how you doing? Like, what were you up to this weekend? Like, stuff where you could establish kind of a mutual trust and respect with athletes where they didn't feel like everything that they said was going to be immediately tweeted. And there are times when I think, you know, you do need to understand that if an athlete says something in a space of like, it's open locker room period, or we're on the range and we're talking, like, and they say something that does rise to the level of news, that's an important thing to understand as a journalist. Like, you have to behave as a journalist, but you can't always be on and always be like, essentially monitoring everything everyone says, or you're never going to build any, you know, trust, because not everything was meant to be a quote in a story. I think it's just kind of an intuition thing. You have to learn to balance it depending on the moment. And Rory is often open and often he reads a lot, right? So he knows the way that I and Andy and Brendan and other people sort of approach covering golf, and is willing to sort of offer up, you know, some insights into things in that way. But so, like, I've had casual conversations with Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas and Scottie Scheffler, and even, you know, a couple times Tiger Woods, and all of those things where you can sort of establish like, hey, I'm not a vulture who's just coming in here trying to like nail you, you know, embarrass you. Or I am just trying to understand what your job is and how you go about it, and give me a better connection to the humanity of things. Those kind of moments, that kind of investment in long term, can be really important. There's a lot of times when I will just kind of walk along the range early in the year at a tournament, and someone will be kind of finishing up their session, and I'll just kind of reach out my hand and I'll just introduce myself and be like, hey, you know, I'm Kevin. I worked for, you know, Friday Golf, and you know, I'll probably be writing about you at some point this year. So I just wanted to say hello. And I think athletes are, unless they're so busy or they're so focused or whatever, they're often kind of appreciative of being like, okay, like, it's nice to put a face to who this is, right? So if I, if I see you like saying something that's frustrating and pissed off, I know who, where to come find you. I know what how to seek you out. Or if you ask a question in a press conference and I feel like it embarrasses me, well, then I know maybe that, you know, I might avoid you next time, or I might want to seek clarity from you elsewhere. But I think all the good people, whether they're feature writers, whether they're beat writers, whether they're on TV or whatever, they learn to have conversations that are not specifically for publications, so that it can set up moments in the future when you might really get something that is valuable and important, that kind of overrules all of that other stuff that might have gotten if you nitpicked every single thing. Outweighs it all.
I'm sure that's just one of the many lessons that you've learned throughout your years and career. You touched on your time at ESPN, you spent some time at the Baltimore Sun before that, and then a couple years at NOAA Laying Up before starting into your current role with Friday Golf. I'm curious how you've seen how golf is covered and how your role in covering golf has sort of shifted and changed as you've moved through these different roles and positions.
I was a feature writer at ESPN for 11 years, and in 2014, Rory McIlroy won two majors. And so no one at ESPN, the magazine where I was a senior writer, really had a lot of interest in golf, but I did. And I sort of said, you know, Rory could be on a path to be, you know, the next Tiger Woods. Like, he just won two majors. He's on an incredible heater. Like, he's going to go for the career Grand Slam in 2015. We should write a big Rory McIlroy feature. ESPN was like, yeah, we need you to keep writing football here and there, but go ahead and basically, like, you know, try to get an interview with Rory, shadow Rory as much as you can. And so I spent kind of all of 2015 chasing him around. And he was at a time when, I kind of like to tease him about this now, but he didn't want to give any big sit down interviews, and he didn't know me from anybody. And so he was like, whatever, like, I'm not interested in talking to this guy. You know, I just kind of leaned hard on the powers of observation. And over the course of like 8 months, I gathered enough stuff that I felt like I had something really interesting and insightful to say. And so we kind of prepared that piece for the following Masters, for the 16. And so that's when it ran. In the course of reporting that story, he got hurt. He hurt his ankle playing soccer before the Open Championship at St. Andrews. And I was scheduled to go to that Open Championship to sort of help, you know, report and write about him. ESPN said, oh, just go ahead anyway, even though he's not going to be there. Like, maybe you can contribute some columns here and there. And while I was there, I sort of said to the golf editor, like, I have this, you know, Tiger's about to miss the cut. Is there any way that I can write like a column about this? Ian O'Connor, who was the regular columnist at ESPN at the time, is now at The Athletic, was like, yeah, I've said enough about Tiger. Like, I have nothing interesting new to say. Like, let Kevin take a crack at this. I wrote, I think, was a pretty good column about Tiger in that moment. And I had written something about Phil Mickelson a couple days prior. And the golf editor and the person who was even above the golf editor liked those things so much that they were like, why don't you just keep continuing to contribute to our golf coverage? Why don't you keep writing columns? And so for the next 3 years, I was essentially a golf columnist. And it was such a great time of my ESPN life, because I could sort of write about, I was like the third columnist at ESPN's golf coverage. And so I would find these like little interesting kind of like almost sidebars, but they would allow me to write about like interesting stories instead of the winner. It was super fun. I ended up becoming friends with the NOAA Laying Up guys and ended up being on the podcast a bunch. And so I learned how to podcast a little bit, which is not something that anybody can really teach you. You just have to do it. Sort of over time, I began to feel like I really like this. Like, I feel like a cathartic sort of spiritual connection to golf. And I feel a little burned out on football. Maybe this is something that I want to do more and more. As I decided that I was going to, you know, take a leap and do something different instead of writing about football for ESPN, that's how I ended up going to NOAA Laying Up and doing podcasts there and trying to do different kinds of podcasts, whether it was like storytelling podcasts or investigative podcasts or deep dive historical podcasts and stuff. And it was a lot of fun. I think kind of helped golf media in some ways, like explore different kind of avenues. I think not like alternative golf media, like new or startup golf media. That was kind of cool to be at the forefront of something. And to be honest, like, I was one of 30, 40 NFL writers at ESPN, but in the golf space, like, I was one of, you know, five people who could write a feature, be on a podcast, be, you know, on some video stuff here and there. It made me like a lot more prominent within the sport by just being a voice in that. Yeah, it was a really fun, neat opportunity to get to sort of, you know, NOAA Laying Up supported like a lot of really cool, interesting storytelling and let me kind of run wild. that was really fun and really cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. You hear that from so many people you speak to now. It's like, you aren't just a writer. You're not just a TV person. You know, you're wearing so many different hats and creating so many different types of content now. Given your career, the varied experiences that you do have, what sort of lessons and advice would you pass along to those that are kind of just getting their start out in journalism now?
This is, I think, less inspirational and more sobering in some ways. But the thing that I try to tell people now is that the model that I came up through, it isn't the one today. And so it's important to sort of understand that like my advice needs to come through that lens. But I tell people now that you have to almost look at, if you want to break into media, you almost have to look at it like you're breaking into the music industry. It's not fair. People who are less talented than you might get opportunities that you think you deserve, and you have to sort of be okay with that. Attractive people might get advantages that you might not if you're not the sort of the shiniest belle of the ball. You have to work really, really hard. There are no guarantees at all. You have to do things and grind and hustle, and there you might not have health insurance. You might not have the things that you want. Some people will make it really big, and their rise will be inexplicable to you. If you are one of those people, you should be thankful that like a luck played a certain role, or so that someone plucked you out of somewhere, someone played favorites with you, someone recognized your really hard work. And if you want to chase that, those are all the things that you have to keep in mind. Like it isn't a slow traditional path of like, if I do good work, I'll be recognized. And it might work out that way, but the more likely sort of reality is that it's a total kind of dice roll. You know, I see a lot of talented people who it doesn't end up working out for. And I see plenty of people who I don't think are talented who are making, you know, a significant sum of money to do work that I don't know if in my opinion, doesn't have a lot of large value. You have to be willing to work really hard, willing to accept that it's not fair. And you have to be really diverse, I think, in your talents. You have to be able to tell stories in different kinds of ways. I think a reporting background is super helpful because I think it can make you stand out in a world that increasingly doesn't have a lot of journalists and reporters, but it's also like not necessary. You don't have to go to journalism school. I think you have to kind of be willing to be ethical, but sometimes some people will get advantages cutting in line because they're not ethical. And so all of that is like, the game, it can be kind of rigged and it can be feel kind of unfair, but it also can have tremendous fun and it can be very different every day. And you have to be willing to sort of take on that challenge if you think this is what you truly want. I mean, nobody told people who came, you know, up from in the music industry, whether it's, you know, Justin Bieber or Jason Isbell or Katy Perry, whatever, that it was going to be like easy, that there would be like a comfortable living if it didn't work out to superstardom. But some of those people like hustled really hard and worked, you know, to make sure that they got their opportunity. And when they got their opportunity, they were ready for it. That's not fun to tell young journalists or whatever, be like, yeah, it might be really unfair. You might not get tabbed to get this job because this person is just genetically beautiful and they're going to put them on television, or they're going to put them on a webcast, or they're going to give opportunities because their dad worked with this person or whatever. But that's the reality. And so if you're willing to go into this, you got to accept that and embrace it and try to overcome it.
And if you're willing to accept all that, you might get to do some pretty cool things, like cover Rory McIlroy completing the career Grand Slam. Absolutely. Thank you for that honest assessment and for all your advice and insights, Kevin Van Valkenburgh. We appreciate the time.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much to Kevin Van Valkenburgh for taking some time out around the holidays to join us for this December edition of the GWAA podcast. Be sure to head over to thefriedegg.com to check out some of his work and to read his bio that shares a lot of details about his background and inspiration for covering the game of golf. I'm Amy Rogers. Thanks for listening.